You're listening to Mom and Doc Talk, where we talk all things healing pans and pandas with an emphasis on homeopathy.
Hi, it's Jody, the mom of the Mom and Doc Talk podcast. We're taking a short pause this summer to enjoy our families and hope you're doing the same. We're also doing some prep work for season two of the Mom and Doc Talk podcast. We've got some really exciting episodes coming your way starting August 27th. In the meantime, we wanted to give you guys the opportunity to catch up on any episodes that you might have missed or take a break. We know you need a break. You deserve a break. Here's a rebroadcast of one of our most popular episodes. We hope you enjoy it.
And welcome to Mom and Doc Talk. We are so excited today. We're excited every day, I swear. But we're just getting so many great people who are joining us to have some really important conversations about health and healing from pans and pandas. And today we are joined by my friend and colleague, Dr. Jill Krista, who is absolutely one of the pioneering experts in mold and mold illness. And I can't wait to talk to her. So let me read you her bio, and so we can just go ahead and dive in. So Dr. Jill Krista is a pioneering naturopathic doctor, best-selling author, devoted educator, and creative innovator. Her superpower is to make complex medical concepts simple and digestible for the average person. Dr. Jill's passion is to elevate the well-being of the planet via the well-being of her inhabitants. Her books and online courses support those wanting concrete steps to conquer health challenges for conditions that cause injury to the brain and nervous system, including mold, pans and pandas, Lyme disease, and concussion. She has now turned her efforts to supporting children and teens struggling with pandas and PANS. As a mother of children affected by PANS, she has combined the knowledge gained through her clinical and personal experience into an indispensable book titled A Light in the Dark for PANS and Pandas. Light in the Dark for Pandas and PANS, and a training for doctors on the topic, approved for AMA Category 1 CME credit. So welcome, Dr. Krista. We are so excited to have you here. You run the gamut with personal experience, of all of the things that you have expertise in. You learn them all the hard way.
Unfortunately.
Like everything, right? I mean, I've heard you present at conferences on mold and on TBI and all sorts of things. And you always start with your personal story. So I would love if you would be willing to start with your personal story for us too.
Sure. Yeah. So I ended up in practice in Southern Wisconsin, coming from Portland, Oregon, where we were in school. And I found myself in heavy metal country. We have lead factories, lead mines, all the things, and south of water treatment, or paper facilities and things like that. So we have all the fun things in the water here. And I was like, okay, well, I'm into environmental medicine, so this would be good. I kind of know how to do this. And then I had patients that didn't necessarily get better from that, and turned out they had Lyme disease, because I'm also in Lyme country. And I thought, I don't really know, what I'm doing with that. So I went and became ILAD certified and learned how to do more of the things that I wasn't comfortable with, like the antibiotics. And it turns out with naturopathic medicine, when you find and treat the cause, people tend to get better. It's magical. But there is still this group of people that, even when we were applying all the tools, and I had all the tools because I came with naturopathic knowledge and added the drug knowledge and then the integration of the two of them, but there was still this group that didn't get better. And they were, chronic Lyme patients, in air quotes, or MS, or, some of these things that just weren't necessarily getting better. And in one of those families, they found toxic black mold in their home when they were remodeling. And the remodelers estimated it was about a 10 to 12 year exposure, because it was something that went wrong when they remodeled the last time. And I was like, I wonder if that's why this guy's gut is a mess. He has ear ringing, he can't sleep, has counterintuitive reactions to medications. So you put him on anti-anxiety stuff and he gets anxious. Start adding up all of the things: pelvic pain, urinary frequency, just anxiety, 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 anxiety. And I thought, well, I don't think I really understand mold. Hit the books. And I really didn't understand mold. I think we got really good training in school on mold, so we knew it was more than just an allergy problem. But I kind of went from allergy to MS, neurological problems. And there's this whole gamut in between. And when I started investigating with the patients, the other people that with, quote, chronic Lyme that weren't getting better, sure enough, they had mold in their history or currently being exposed. And it was just, at the time, it was just seen as like a blight. Like, oh, mm-hmm. it's just an aesthetic problem. Oh, we're just going to paint over that ugh, gross looking stuff, you know? And so it wasn't really seen as a health issue. And mm-hmm. when we started to find and address the cause, they started getting better. And we did nothing different in their Lyme protocol. And in many yeah. cases needed to back off on the Lyme protocol because it was too strong now that their immune system was able to tell us. So then I was thinking, wow, because I speak at conferences. I was putting together a proposal to speak at a conference and we found mold in my house. So mm-hmm. here I was putting together a doctor training and dealing with brain fog and dealing with, you know, what I thought was perimenopause, and my kids were going through puberty and I thought it was all puberty, all the stuff they were going through, and they had PANS already. So, you know, it was just like, oh, we're having a flare. It's the hormones, you know? And so you kind of start writing things off when it's mold. And I know, Jody, you had said everybody has different symptoms, you know? And so that was the thing. It's like, it wasn't that we all got a rash, or it wasn't that we all got joint pain, or, you know, whatever the symptom is. And when the flood revealed itself, it was like, oh, this is mold. Okay. I actually know what to do about this. I knew the remediator I wanted to call, the inspector I wanted to call. I knew the protocol that I was using with my patients. And that's when I was like, I got to write a book, because this is not rocket science. And most people can get themselves better with these techniques. So then I became an author, which was really weird.
Author and speaker. And your book is great. We've both read your book. And I don't have a physical copy. I have it on Kindle, so I don't have it here to like show, but, it is really accessible. It's a brief and accessible book. So many books about mold are like just unbelievably dense. And it's like a double whammy, right? Because the person is dealing with mold illness and they're trying to read this really dense book that's about mold illness, but they can't think it through because they have mold illness. And it's, so that's one thing that's great about your book is that it's a lot more accessible. And like you said in your bio, that you are really good at sort of making things really, that are really complex, a lot more simple. And so I really appreciate that about your approach.
Thank you. That means a lot. That means a lot, because yeah. that was done very purposefully.
Yeah. I definitely wish I would have known about, or I don't know what year that you wrote the book, but it would have been so helpful whenever we had our mold experience to have just this kind of simplified roadmap laid out. So that's what, you know, one thing when reading it, I was like, oh, okay, this is super easily digestible by a mom that's in the tunnel and going through it right now.
Right. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I put a lot of it. I had a lot of divorces with some fancy words.
Thank you. We appreciate that.
I love this paragraph. This is so awesome. But it's got to go because it's just too many words, you know? So yeah.
I'm working on that too for my own writing, to like cut things down. And I have a tendency to write like Samuel Hahnemann. For anybody who has read anything by Samuel Hahnemann, one sentence could be an entire paragraph and lots of clauses and extra things. So I'm working on that myself. So if you've got tips, I'll definitely take it offline.
I will share a very, very simple phrase that my writing coach was saying: don't get married to your words. Don't get married to your words. Don't get married to your words. And it's so good. And also I had brain fog, you know? So it was I knew what that was like, to just be like, your eyes wear out. Mold hits the eyes really hard. And there's just only so many, it's like the EMDR treatment for detox, you know, you're reading back and forth and it just like done, you know, my brain just went into tox mode. So
Well, speaking of words, you shared in a recent email that mold exposure can be a trigger for PANS. We definitely see that, you know, even if there's no other illness, that mold can be like the main trigger for PANS. And so you conceptualize it through an alteration of the lung microbiome. I would love if you could speak to that a little bit more.
Yeah. So it affects, so mold is so tricky. If it's the spore exposure, so mold can affect our body through spores, spore fragments, mold chemicals, which are like the off-gas chemicals from metabolizing mold, but then also this whole other set of chemicals called mycotoxins. And the mycotoxins are the thing for me that get my attention, because they're made on purpose by mold to poison and harm another living being. Like the off-gas chemicals, that's just, I jokingly call my book, those are mold farts, you know, like they're just off-gassing, they're just metabolizing, farting away and whatever, you know. So that's things like alcohols, aldehyde, so people can become really sensitive to like the new smell of furniture, because that's formaldehyde. But mycotoxins are made on purpose to harm, and they can cause all kinds of different changes in our genetics, in our immune system. So if someone's exposed to just the spore part and we get the classic allergy thing with mast cells, that alone can change the lining of our respiratory passages, our sinuses, and our lungs. But when you add the mycotoxin, which was made on purpose to be poisonous to our immune system, then you get these changes in the biome of your lungs that have a direct line up to the brain that says, we're being poisoned, we got a problem, send a lot of inflammation. And it'll just create tons of inflammation in the body, just like we see with PANS kids, if they get an infection or they lose a tooth or something like that, or they can sprain an ankle, you know, and all of a sudden the body has this inflammatory response. When there's more blood-brain barrier leakage in a PANS kid, anything that's going on in the body can flare what's going on in the brain. So what we see with mold is that the mycotoxins create a leaky blood-brain barrier and a leaky gut barrier and a leaky lung barrier, actually. So all of our barriers get leaky: skin, lungs, gut. And that now those chemicals, when we're smelling them in and we're taking them into our lungs, they can set off this response that says to the brain, we're not safe. Like, first of all, get anxious, get fearful, and get out of here, because that's the whole purpose of, you know, that message is like, there's a tiger, we're not safe. Well, your brain goes looking around for the tiger and it doesn't see anything, doesn't smell anything, because if it's just the mycotoxins, they have no odor. So if everything's trapped behind building material, you can be getting sick from mycotoxins because they're nanoparticle sized. And you can be breathing them into your lungs and they go into the deepest, deepest depths of the lungs because they're so small. And they can be setting off that trigger that has the direct connection up to the brain that says, we got a problem. And it'll change dopamine receptors. That alone can start dopamine receptor damage, which is something we see consistent with pandas and PANS. So it can be just mold and no infection that turns it on.
Yeah. I think one of the problems with our family is I didn't know what I was looking for. Like, warning signs were going off, but I didn't know what I should be watching for. So what are some of the early signs that you could potentially be dealing with mold illness?
I think the things are where you've done everything that makes sense and you're still not getting a response. So kind of the story I was telling about the Lyme patients, you know, where you're doing the right diet. And so there are plenty of things we as families can do to clean things up, you know, like better about bedtime, better about not overextending our kids and not having too many overnights in a row, better about, you know, what we're feeding them, taking the time to actually do good, healthy meals. And then things can happen, you know, even when you're doing everything perfectly, things can happen with kids, you know, and with families. So if you're starting to see that if you are having symptoms and you're addressing them with a truly holistic way, whether that's, you know, classical homeopathy to adjust your susceptibility. I know, Jen, you talk about that a lot. Or if you're, you know, okay, we could have cleaned up a little bit around the diet. We're doing all those things and you're just not seeing responses. That's kind of a big thing. And everyone in the house, it's more the rule than the exception that everyone in that exposure will have a different expression. And that's what makes it so hard, because it's going to depend on your own personal susceptibility, somewhat on genetics, but not so much the HLA as the detox genetics, because we're dealing with a toxin illness as well. What's your nutritional status? If the person's been exposed prior, if the person's been exposed to these mycotoxins in utero, so if mom was pregnant and was in a moldy situation, you can be out of that moldy situation, but if it's the same mycotoxin later in life, you have an instant susceptibility to that. There's a molecular memory in the brain that will actually say, okay, it's back. We're being poisoned. Shut the systems down. And your body will go into something called cell danger response, where it literally puts you on low power mode because it doesn't want to take in too much of that toxin. So there are kind of clusters of things. They're a little bit different in a kid than they are in a grown-up. In a grown-up, we see fatigue being one of the primary things. And if you're a competitive athlete, that's a little hard to pick up on. You know, like somebody will be like, oh, I think my VO2 max is going down, you know, and I can't work out as hard as, or I have a, you know, it takes me more days to recover or something like that. But for the general public that isn't, you know, competitive athlete and oxygenating their body, it's going to be fatigue, and that can be brain fatigue, that can be body fatigue usually. And that can come along with EMF sensitivity, because when we move our body, we make EMFs, they're internal ones. But then you can also become sensitive to the external ones. You can start to notice, like, I'm sensitive to Wi-Fi now, you know, like I can't go to whatever building because there's all the Wi-Fi's happening at the same time. So fatigue is a big one. Anxiousness is a big one. And then some sort of gut disruption, usually urinary symptoms like urinary frequency. And we see that with PANS, even though the clinical criteria doesn't talk about it at all. Urinary stuff is going on with a lot of these kids. You know, I would say in my patient population, like 85%. So some kind of cluster. And in kids, there's going to be skin, respiratory behavior. Those are kind of the three categories that kids will display. But I do have a questionnaire for this, actually, that I've made for myself in practice, because I was, you know, after seeing Lyme patients, I was like, oh, well, how am I going to tell the difference? Because the Venn diagram of the two is so overlapping. How in the heck am I going to know the difference? Because I wanted to get to solution faster and not mess around with a bunch of Lyme treatment if it was really mold behind it. So I created a questionnaire, and it has a scoring system so you can score yourself. Dr. Neil, Nathan, and I are working on a research study right now with that questionnaire to validate it. We don't know, and I can already kind of answer. I definitely, in practice, modify that for the kids in my practice. For the real younger kids, like 4 and under, it's not necessarily an applicable scoring system for them. But, you know, for like a grade schooler on up, you can use it for kids too.
And this is the same one that's available in your book, right?
Yep, it's been modified now. So if anyone wants it, that's on my website. Yep. And then the research study is a crowdsourced thing, and that's on moldiq.org.
We'll make sure we put links to all of the things, like where you can find the questionnaire, your website, and all that in the show notes at the end.
I think go ahead.
You go ahead, Jody.
Oh, I was just saying, doing that for each one of your family members, because looking back now, I think for all PANS family members, literally the second that we think, huh, I wonder if my other kid has PANS too, or holy cow, my husband just did a thing that looks kind of PANS-ish, like the mold alarm should be sounding if everybody's having these elevated things going on.
Perfect. Yeah. And the things that I just listed off, was that consistent with what you saw symptom-wise in your family?
Yeah.
I forgot to say vision changes.
Yeah. Literally I'm like reliving everything that you said. And even the thing that you were saying about, you know, my daughter, I was pregnant with her when we were in mold. And she was born, she's my mast cell kiddo that was born super, super sick, has always been sick. Her healing journey has been much longer. Avery moved into mold, and it took her a while before, I guess, her bucket filled up, and between the mold and the infections, it just like crashed into PANS. So that makes a lot of sense too, that it just takes a while. And if they're literally in utero in mold and then born into mold, it's like just a crazy storm.
Right. It does prime the immune system to preferentially choose mast cells over the other parts of the immune system. Mm-hmm. And that can be, you know, for their whole childhood. There is that kind of thing of getting into puberty, you know, you can see a little bit of a change, but it's a tough spot. And then you're chasing, you know, another boulder down a hill, which is like, okay, but we also have to take care of this mast cell kind of problem. And that's, I think, where homeopathy is just shines, because it's that susceptibility part. Like in my PANDAS book, Jen, if you read that section on homeopathy, you're probably like, okay, you know, but it was just like to give everyone like a very short summary idea of like, how would you pick one remedy over the other? It's a lot of people can't get a provider. So I was trying to just provide like a little short, quick guide, like the keynotes kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, I've heard from families that are like, oh my God, Burrito Carb just rescued my kid. Like I didn't believe that this could happen. It's like, that can change the susceptibility. And then you're not dealing with so much flare ability when they do have mast cells recruited and those kinds of things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So just to summarize, I mean, like the reality here is that mold can look like so many other things and can make so many other things worse or get stuck in their progress with treatment. And so it can be really confusing. And so the reality is like we said, it can look like so many other things. So it could look like other health conditions completely too. So the questionnaire is a good starting place, especially if you're treating those things and they're not improving or they're improving to a point and then get stuck. I mean, we definitely see that in our practice that kids will make really great progress and then get to a point where they are just stuck. And in many of those cases, we find mold and the mold needs to be remediated. And then they can start improving with homeopathy again, because it's more about they've reached the point where their body's done what they can with the constant like re-exposure. And Samuel Hahnemann, the founder of homeopathy, is, I'm sure you are very well aware, even talked about like an obstacle to healing is living in a dank cellar, which, you know, he was talking about mold. He didn't say mold, but he was talking about mold, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is why we have you here and why we have our next episode is actually about mold remediation too, because these are things that are important to talk about. So when we get to that place where it's just like, oh my gosh, okay, we know we've got Lyme, we know we've got this. Is mold another part of the picture? That can just be so overwhelming for people. And then trying to figure out, like, is this definitely the route that do we have to do this? Like, that's what we hear from so many people, right? Do I have to do this? And it's overwhelming for lots of reasons, right? Just like much of mold treatment is not covered by insurance. Right. There's questions about like, you know, is mold remediation going to be covered by homeowners insurance if you own your home? And if it is, does it then put you at risk of potentially losing your insurance if you're in a place that's like a higher risk place anyway? It's so many things that go into it. So most people then want to figure out, okay, let's do testing to see if we have to do this, right? If it's absolutely necessary. But then there's lots of different things you can test, right? You can test the body, you can test the environment. So what testing do you recommend, both for the body and the environment, or do you recommend one over the other to make the decision for like that tree of like the billion decisions that come with when mold is a possibility?
Right. Because there's the hard thing is that every building is as much an individual as every body. So there is no standard. There's no, you know, this works for every situation. No. And that's why my inspector is my favorite asset in my practice, because she's so well-trained. She can come in. And even in times where I've thought it was mold and it wasn't mold, it was carbon monoxide or it was mothballs or something else that was making the person sick and toxic and look like a mold patient. Yeah. But where we start in the body, there, everything's moving in this because it is, it's a new-ish kind of condition. I mean, it's been around as long as the Bible. It's talked about in the Bible, but as far as how we can test for it, every test has its strengths and its weaknesses. And so when people say, what's your favorite body test? I always reply that that's the wrong question. The right question is, what's the best test for the situation? You know, what question are we trying to answer? And what's the best one for the patient in front of me? You know, if you have a 3-year-old, even if you are thinking, wow, a serum mycotoxin antibody would be really helpful right now, you may not want to be doing a blood draw on them. Mm-hmm. So you might go with a urine mycotoxin test, even if it isn't like answering the question that you're perfectly wanting to answer. But for me, usually in my situation with my patients, it's okay, we now have done everything that makes sense. And now we think it might be mold. Then they get referred to me. And then it's like, cause she knows about mold. And the question is, are we in mold right now? And so when we're trying to answer that question, there's a trio of ways that we can sort of build the argument that they're probably in mold. One of those is the MyMyco Lab Serum Mycotoxin Antibody Test, IgE. So there's an IgG and an IgE. It doesn't follow like the way we were trained, you know, the immunoglobulins and when one gets recruited and when another one gets recruited. Toxin illnesses don't follow that pattern. So they can have an IgG normal and an IgE high. But if that's so when we see that, you know, as doctors who've been trained in the viral model of immunoglobulins, it can be like, well, then what does that mean? Are they in mold or aren't they in mold? And in my experience, an IgE being high means you're exposed to mold to a significant degree for the previous 2 weeks. So 2 to 4, Dr. Campbell would say 4 weeks because it's toxin. That really helps make that argument, because if it is IgE high and IgG high, That means they're making both kinds of immunoglobulins to that type of mold, that family of mold or that mold spore, the toxin coming from that mold spore. So I will combine that with a VCS test, which is a visual contrast sensitivity test. I like VCSTest.com for doing that because they have you calibrate your screen so that you don't get as many false positives or false negatives. And then we combine that with a urine mycotoxin or MPA, so mycophenolic acid, which is actually not a mycotoxin. And it's really important that we know that because what it means is that this is one of those chemicals that actively living metabolizing mold is off-gassing. So if you have a high mycophenolic acid on a urine test and you're not doing anything to like pull that out or detox that out, and you have a bad visual contrast sensitivity, and you have immediate sensitivity IgE in your bloods, they have mold in their space. Like I can feel very confident in saying that. And it needs to be tracked down. So that's kind of the sort of thing that I'm looking at is, well, what question are we trying to answer? And in many times that is the big question. And so combining those is really important. Sometimes though, we're just trying to get like, okay, we knew they were in mold. They either remediated or they moved and we knew it was good. You know, how much is this still a mold problem? Like it, you know, we're out of mold. So is this even still a problem? Do we need to keep doing all of this therapy? That's when it's nice to just run a urine mycotoxin test and see what the body burden is. Because these mycotoxins are, the ones that are actual mycotoxins are fat soluble or oil soluble. So they can be taken up in the body and bioaccumulate. You can get a huge load. So, you know, that idea of like, Jody, you're saying your daughter, like after a while, then the bucket was full, boom. That, if we can get the bucket down to, you know, a quarter or less, or even normal, like people say, is there any such thing as a normal urine mycotoxin test? And yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I get zeros all the time. So you can heal from this. And then that reduces your total susceptibility. And I know you had mentioned, Jody, about, you know, homeopathy helped you just kind of like, wow, there were all these toxins that were in my body and I just wasn't able to get rid of because the body didn't have the wisdom or the highlight wasn't on it saying, you know, hey, we still have this other thing. So I like to treat until we get zeros because it's going to reduce your susceptibility for the next thing. And especially in families who have PANDAS and PANS or an autoimmune disease, Hashimoto's, MS, those kinds of things. It's like whatever your genetics are, make you susceptible. And that is passed down to your kids. And so let's go for zeros. And that, you know, it's only because I've seen that way, way, way too many times where a family was like, good enough, you know, and then just basically live on antihistamines. And then we end up with a kid with lymphoma. And it's like, no, these are carcinogenic toxins. This is something we need to get out of the body. Squeeze it out like a sponge. Let's get rid of all of it. Yeah. So for body, for environment, it's not my area of expertise. Like there's people who spend their whole life's work doing that, like I do with bodies. So I love to rely on them. But I think the general trend in the industry is to not pay attention to mycotoxins. It's still very focused on spore. So, you know, qPCR testing of the spores, let's speciate, all very important, super important to do. And look at the mycotoxins and look at the endotoxins. Because this damp buildings host mixed microbes. Of all of the toxins that you can be exposed to, endotoxins are just like the cell wall of a bacteria. They're just that a bacteria died. Oops, my bad. My cell wall is all over the place. Like, oops, sorry. You know, actinomycetes, they're off-gassing. Their fart, so to speak, is an antibiotic. So we have to do, you know, by knowing what species are there, we know what kind of therapy we can do. So with actinomycetes, we have to do a lot of like rebuilding of the terrain. I like to use humic acid in the nose, kind of like let's build that terrain back because that's going to be all disrupted. Whereas with mycotoxins, that's the intention in that toxin is to harm. And so they really, really get my attention. So I think that only doing building testing on spores and spore fragments and speciation, while that's really important, is missing what's making my patients, the majority of their symptoms, you know, between 70 and 75%, is due to the mycotoxins.
Yeah. So I'm curious about with like all of the different testing options that there are, and like, you know, if you find that somebody, if you test the body and they find that they have mold illness, well, then it's like, okay, well, now where do we need to test? Do we need to test in the home? Do we need to test at work? Do we need to test at school? And I know that there are some people that I've heard that will choose to test the environment first, because if they have strong suspicion that the body has mold illness and they're trying to just like, you know, they have limited resources or whatever, or limited time, that they'll jump right to testing the environment. Do you find any disadvantage in just jumping right to testing the environment with presumptive mold illness?
Mm-mm. No, I'm a big fan of that. That's why I have my questionnaire, because people are strapped financially, you know? And so that's the nice thing about having a questionnaire that just gives you a score, and why we're, Dr. Nathan and I are working to validate the questionnaire, like Dr. Horowitz did for Lyme. His MSIDS questionnaire is validated. Like, you don't need to spend money on Lyme testing. Take his test. Mm-hmm. Take his quiz. You know, it's like, it's only going to take you time and, you know, pencil graphite. That's the only expense on that, you know? So that's what we're trying to achieve with the questionnaire. I think the only caveat to that is that there are very few people, and I know you're going to have Michael Schrantz on, which is somebody who's really looking at he's very experienced. He's kind of like a savant in the mold world. You know, there are very few people like him. There are very few people that are looking and are trained to have the bigger picture look, and that actually understand this is much more than an aesthetic issue. So mm-hmm. I think, you know, my only asterisk on that is that, sure, it's fine to do the building testing and skip the body testing and just get going on, you know, treating it, as long as that building testing is thorough. And that means that you have an inspector, or even, you know, there are the We Inspect guys have a training you can take to do your own inspection. And then mm-hmm. if you find problematic areas, you can send samples into them, and then they'll do the assessment and tell you what they found. Mm-hmm. But they have this whole thing of like how to actually take the sample and, you know, basically do your own DIY, which is really cool. So they have like three levels that they can help you with, the, you know, we'll come to your house level, but not everybody is close to a good inspector. I'm very lucky where I live. So there are those kinds of options, but there's something called the dust test that I like, because they're looking at the PCR, speciation, mycotoxins, and endotoxins. So that's giving kind of, because we had a situation in my house, mold, I was the perfect person to have this happen to, because I turned into a testing crazy person, and I recorded everything. One of these days I will actually sit down and make a video of like, here's what it looked like, here's what we found, here's the testing. Cause I was just trying to learn, you know, and it was my house. So I was like, I can say, yeah, tear that up. Let's look underneath it. Cause it was my basement.
Right.
So we tested everything, like swab. I took a swab, a tape lift, and a bulk sample of everything, and found that the bulk samples actually got us the best results. And so the guys that were doing my house, they were so used to me, like, you know, putting on my Tyvek suit and the whole respirator or whatever. And whenever they'd find something, they'd be, you know, like, you're going to come on and test this. And so I'd run down and test it. And there was one board that was just vegetative and disgusting. And they were like, oh, it's going to be totally. So we, you know, we're all deciding, what mold do you think it is? You know, and trying to do predictive stuff. It came back completely clear of mold, even though it looked like a classic Petri dish. And, and I was like, what are you talking about? And we were all shocked, and called our inspector, and she said, test it for endotoxin. I bet that's bacterial. And she was right. It was an entire board that had gray water spill, and it was all bacteria, even though it looked like fungus. So we need to know all of it, I think, is really helpful for us as practice. Because if it is endotoxin, we know there's a bacterial problem, and we need to address their biome from that direction.
Well, that was going to be my last question for you on testing, is how does testing of the body impact treatment decisions?
Yes. So for I refer to mycotoxins inappropriately as a single unit, but they are all extremely biologically diverse, and they do different things in the body, and they act differently. So there are some that cross the blood-brain barrier, there's some that don't. Some need the blood-brain barrier to be leaky in order to get through, and some don't. Some affect the liver, some affect the kidneys, some bioactivate in utero. So if I have a pregnant mama in mold and I see certain things like cadmium or aniotin, I'm like, get out at all costs. Stay with whoever you need to stay with, live in your car, you know, mm-hmm. to hang out at a restaurant, whatever you need to do. Like, you cannot be in this space because these bioactivating in utero means it becomes 10 to 20 times more toxic to baby than it is to mom. Because once it gets into that little placental sac, it has certain chemicals in there that can make it more toxic. So every mycotoxin is different. And I have a fact sheet on my website for each one. I have a couple still to get up there. But if you just go to drkrista.com/enter the mycotoxin, you'll get a specific fact sheet that tells you how to detoxify that specific toxin. Yeah. Great question. Okay.
There were a few surprising things in your book that I suspect that some of our listeners would be surprised, or that would surprise them. Things like dust feeds mold and mycotoxins actually have no smell. Can you talk about that and what other things we should know that we might be surprised by?
Yeah, you can have a no water damage building house and still have a mold problem. And it can be from moisture. And that's been a couple of cases, you know, like people who had a lot of, I live in the Midwest and we're like a basement community, you know, everybody has a basement and they all finish their basements and store stuff in the basement. And we've had more than a few times where their mold problem was because they had cardboard boxes sitting on their basement floor. And the cardboard was just wicking up that little bit of moisture. I mean, the best way in nature to find water is to dig a hole and water will fill in. So that, what are we doing? We're digging holes and we're putting our house on top of a hole and then expecting that no water is going to want to come into that space. That's just not how it works. So, you know, you can get wicking up from concrete building or concrete floors, but also from dust. So there've been, there's a family actually I was just working with. They had a root cellar and they had, you know, all of their food stores, their canned goods and that kind of stuff. And it had like a quarter inch of mold on top of all of them. This is where they would come and get their food every day. And that was just from dust buildup and not managing it. And it was moist enough. If it's just over 50% humidity, you can get mold growth on dust. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Dust with gusto. That's one of my...
So I've got a couple of questions for you about things that impact come up in like, you know, chronic health circles widely, but especially in the pandas community. And that's biofilms and candida. And I'm curious if you can talk to us a little bit about how mold impacts biofilms and how mold and candida are related.
Yeah. So not everyone with mold illness has candida, but a lot of them do have candida mm-hmm. overgrowth. And not everyone with candida overgrowth has a mold problem. So, you know, I just want to kind of say that there's a lot of crossover. And candida overgrowth isn't just like a given with mold. But the mm-hmm. way that it changes the microbiome, you can kind of see how it sets the stage for it. So what happens when we're first exposed to these mycotoxins, I see it kind of like a continuum of response. The very first response is the body says, whoa, that's a toxin. Let's make a lot of snot, because snot has digestive enzymes and things that can denature these toxins. And it also has the flushing away aspect of it. So our body will react on a mucosal lining layer that will encourage the body to just clear out or neutralize that toxin. But if it happens over time and continuously as you're exposed, that natural microbiome is going to start to shift where your own endogenous healthy commensal microbiome starts to act kind of defensively, because now the message is fungus is trying to move in. Fungus is trying to move in. That's what the mycotoxin message is, hey, I'm fungus and I'm coming in to take over your system. And so then your own microbiome can become a factory of toxin if those things are persistent enough. And so over time, that causes immune depletion of your barriers. And now if you have immune depletion, now the things that are commensal can start to act a little naughty. And if that goes on long enough and you become immune depleted enough, the spores from that moldy building move into you and you become the moldy building. And that's essentially what a biofilm setup is. The biofilm is basically a healthy commensal microbiome that's been altered in a defensive way and an immune depletion way, that now the things that should be commensal but then can become a little pathogenic start to create like little houses of this matrix of calcium and magnesium to kind of protect itself. And then the spores have this perfect setup to basically become a new, you're the building for it now, just a new host to these fungi.
Yeah. And how are biofilms impacted by mold?
The biofilm can, so the mycotoxins, the message in there saying fungus is coming to move in, can actually cause the biofilm to act more aggressively. So you can get this quorum sensing that happens with biofilms, which is basically where all the microbes are communicating. They're a little bit in competition with each other, but they need each other because some are good about sensing when your immune system is down and when you're, you know, more susceptible to infection, when it can grow, when it can't, that kind of thing. So as those toxins are coming into the system, then the biofilm can get more aggressive. And that's when then I see a lot of people taking on things like parasites, because we're eating parasites all the time. But when you have more biofilm in your gut or in your sinuses, that can become then an easier place for those kinds of things to take hold.
Yeah.
It's one of those things that can be really tricky too, because, you know, biofilms are a normal part of life. And so I don't want to, and like all the stuff that you just shared is like worst case scenario, right? Like a lot of people, these things don't happen to, depending on their susceptibility, and, you know, a myriad of things. So it's not like, you know, mold is coming for all of us and we're all going to have like this, you know, horrible reaction to it. There is a wide array of things, but it's right. We do need to talk about like worst case scenario type of situations, so that people who are really, really struggling have some resources to lean on.
Yeah. And that's why I have things in a stepwise order that I describe in my book. It's this peel the orange, because as you go through the steps, there are 50% of people just getting out of mold, they get better because their bodies just say, "Ooh, that was horrible. Let's detox that." Yeah. And, you know, they have some loose stool for a while and big deal, we're done, you know? So, you know, that's why I have it in that system, because as you peel those layers of, so we have peeling the layers of an onion is how you heal, but a therapeutic order, as you get rid of the exposure, which is the first thing, which is avoidance, easiest thing to say, hardest thing to do is, you know, a lot of people get better after that. And then for people that don't have the fundamentals in place of, like we were just saying, you know, circadian rhythm and diet and that kind of thing, take care of that, people get better. But then you get into the orange part, which is, you know, trying to set up the body to be able to take on the toxin and the immune depletion that happened and that kind of thing, those changes, then people get better. Not everybody has to go to the next step. So that's the idea. And I put biofilm in my book because a lot of people do, once they've, you know, if they've seen other people or whatever, and they're working through the steps and they're not better yet, that's when biofilm can be really, really helpful to add in some enzymes or something like that. That's going to be, and even ginger is a biofilm buster, you know, like it doesn't have to be this aggressive thing. It can be like, okay, you need to eat a ginger chew or two after you eat every meal. Okay. You know, who doesn't want that? But, you know, I mean, it can be easier than we make it sound, but I see the biofilm as like, it, again, it's that continuum of like a biofilm is just your microbiome acting naughty. We just want to shift it back into commensal.
Yeah. And from the homeopathy perspective, reducing your susceptibility to having the specific reaction that you have to the biofilm or to the different things, because again, we all have different presentations of things too. So the susceptibility getting shifted with homeopathy and then removing the biofilm in the first place too.
Yeah. And that's the thing, like you said, like we're not trying to sterilize the surface, you know, we're trying to move it to a microbiome. And we, when we say microbiome, we're always thinking of like, these are all the beneficial species and that kind of thing. But we see with all kinds of things like glyphosate and exposure and things like that, that you're, it hosts more pathogenic species than beneficial in a normal microbiome. So for me, this idea of biofilm is a pretty broad gray area that is just basically we're hosting more non-commensal than we want and not enough commensal that we do want. And so how do we make that change?
Yeah. And I mean, that's an important thing that you and I were chatting about very briefly before we got started, is that, like, you know, we do need to be careful, or at least in my opinion, we need to be careful with how we are approaching handling mold, because we don't want to overdo it like we did with antibiotics, where we, you know, really, really disrupted our microbiome through the liberal use of antibiotics. And I have concerns that we're doing that with mold, fungus, and parasites as well, that we're just like trying to destroy them all like they're all bad. But the reality is that there's a normal micro, you know, fungal microflora and parasitic microflora. Like it's all part of how we function. So making sure that we're careful with it, but yeah, not ignoring it at the same time.
Right. Cause some, you know, there are people who have had so much immune depletion that you're just like, okay, well, we've got this force we're dealing with, so let's meet it with this force. Mm-hmm. But I really take that point of like overdoing it in anything, you know, on the antis. And that's, you know, why I have the steps, because yep, when you detoxify the body and you start to do immune modulation, not everybody needs to go on itraconazole to get better, yep, you know? And
I really appreciate that about your approach, that like, that it's like a couple of things that are just establishing basics, establishing conditions for health. And then, mm-hmm, and looking at if you still need support, then look at these other areas that, you know, could be beneficial. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And when we had said before we started, I think it's so important too, because we're all attracting a patient population that resonates with how we do things, you know, because not everybody needs the thing. Like I'll knock people out of the water that mm-hmm really actually needed homeopathy, and, you know, vice versa. Mm-hmm. So, you know, yep, I just think it's so important that we have all of us, this whole team, and these yep different approaches, because there isn't one way to do this. This is exactly about the patient and the patient's individual, you know, body and what they need. Kind of going back right to the testing thing. It's like, well, what's your favorite test? I don't know. What patient are we talking
about? Depends on the person. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Totally. Yeah. Well, I appreciate that you guys are talking about the whole, we don't need to kill everything and all. And I am going to ask you both to continue to talk about that, because there aren't a lot of providers in the PANS world. Whenever we come into this, we hear over and over and over again, because of course we're scratching to try and get help and find somebody to help us. So we hear a lot of, you know, what this person did or what that person did. And it feels like so much of it is you got to go after and you got to kill it all. And you got to do this protocol, and you have to get rid of all the parasites and everything. So I think it's going to take a little bit for this to sink into the PANS community. So again, I encourage both of you to continue to talk about it, because it's just a hard thing to believe. Like, I remember the first time Dr. Barr told me, you know, that I didn't want to kill all the parasites in my kid's body. I was like, like, yes, I do. and it took a good long while for me to understand the whole, like, overdoing it isn't good as well. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And at the same time, like, I've seen some big old worms come out of kids, you know.
That right. And like, you want to get rid of the ones that are problematic. But then we have a lot of people who are using helminth therapy, which is like the strategic use of parasites for treatment. So, like, right, we just have to recognize that. That's all. That's all.
Yeah. I was researching helminth therapy, like the science, because, you know, I use it, but I didn't necessarily have to teach it to anybody. But then for my course, when I was like, okay, I kind of have to explain why this is working, it was really cool, because I found that in research, they're using the exosomes from them and not the critters themselves. I don't know if that's available anywhere commercially yet. But I'm really excited about that, because I feel like that is one thing that makes me nervous about helminth therapy, is, you know, if in a constipated kid, you know, we could be causing them to have that infection. And so it's like, wow, we could give the messengers and not have to actually give the microbe. And I think that's where a lot of that kind of more precision, you know, that's what I'm doing with the mycotoxins, is trying to just, let's put a little precision on this so we can get it out faster and support the system, so we're not taxing it while we detox it. But it's really cool, like peptides and exosomes and all these things. It's very exciting to see.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what recommendations do you offer families that can't afford expensive remediations and like leaving all their stuff behind?
Oh, it's so hard. Like I say, I have kind of three rules of thumb of remediation from working with a lot of different families. And when I first learned about this, I started going to their homes and like following the inspector around and checking on the remediation, you know, because I just really wanted to understand. You're better off living in a house with studs and not actually. So, if, you know, if you're facing like, oh my gosh, the tear out is going to cost this much and the rebuild is going to cost this much, don't even worry about rebuild. And I know it's really hard to say, but I've been there, and you can walk on subfloor for a very long time. Like, put down a cheap old rug that you get at Home Depot and just keep it that way. If you can't afford that, spend the money on getting the toxic stuff out of your home. So, you know, cutting out the three rules of thumb are, you know, no spray and pray. Cause that's a big thing, is there are these companies that are coming around saying, oh, we'll fog your house so you don't even have to remove anything. We wouldn't do that with skin cancer. You know, we wouldn't spray essential oils over you and say, oh, we don't have to cut out that skin cancer, cause it's going to grow. And that's what mold will do. It will always grow back. So don't waste their money on those kinds of things. Source removal is and has always been, even in Leviticus, when they write about it in the Bible, removing the source, removing the stones that were moldy out of the stone house and taking it to an unclean place outside of town, because it can, you know, swoop back in on the air. So source removal is the most important thing. Don't just spray stuff on it. Don't paint over it. Take out more than you think. So on a limited budget, I have people say, you know, ask the remediators, how many days do they think this is going to take? And we always find more mold, almost always. I don't know if there's a case where we didn't, and they had to pay for them to come back a second time. So that's a second trip charge, a second containment. So they have to pay for all that containment one more time. Just ask them for an extra day and pay for that extra day. And then when they find more, they can address it right then. They have all the containment. You've only paid for that once. You've only paid one trip charge, one containment, one air scrubber. You know, you're not having to pay for two. So, and that's just from having gone through it. Yeah. So take out more than you think. No spray and pray, no seal and deal. We're not going to just seal it up with paint.
Can you talk a little bit more about your remediation kind of rules of thumb?
Yeah, that was kind of the rules of thumb. Yeah.
Yeah, you start. Yeah, I thought you had four or five. There's the no spray and pray.
No seal and deal. So that's the thing. It's like, we'll put seal and paint over it and, you know, and then take out more than you think. It's a big one.
Okay. Yeah. Three.
And then, you know, number four is dork, stay healthy. So don't be that person. I've gotten phone calls from a former NFL player who was just like, I'm a tough guy. I'll just go into my house after a hurricane hit it. And he basically he thought he was having a stroke. He had all the symptoms of having a stroke after that, and was found himself in the ER, and they're like, we don't know what's wrong with you. And his wife thankfully kind of knew about mold. And she goes, I told you should have worn a mask. And so, you know, I mean, he had given himself stroke symptoms by not being a dork. Go ahead and be a dork, wear all the protective gear, be the man in white suits, you know, just wear the respirator, dork, stay healthy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we are running short on time, so I want to narrow it down to a couple of questions just to wrap up, because you've got so much really great information in your book. And so we definitely recommend that people buy the book, and you've got a course too, that we can put a link to, for that people can send their doctors to take your course if they want to get more of that like physician level training. I've taken the course. It's fantastic. I am curious though, before we dive into like just a little bit, last few wrap up questions, I'm curious if you have any thoughts about like the long-term use of mold-based antibiotics in pandas kids.
Yeah. So we will see that the antibiotics that come from the molds the child is exposed to are really hard on that kid. So it's important there. Also, when you were talking about the families that, do we do the body testing or do we do the building testing? If they're actively being exposed to mold, or they're thinking they are, it's really helpful to have that building result in the species, because then we can make sure to choose, if we have to use an antibiotic, one that doesn't come from that mold, because they're going to have more problems, and it will continue to send the message that fungus is winning. So it puts the child into more chances of having resistant species and biofilm if they are taking the toxin, the mycotoxin, so penicillin, is from penicillium mold. Amoxicillin is from penicillium mold. Aspergillus and penicillium are the most commonly found toxicogenic molds in homes. So that's why I think a lot of kids are faring better on like the cephalosporins when they need an antibiotic, because that's from a different kind of mold. So we don't to be adding that.
I'm really curious if there's like a reverse situation happening too, that people who are not like necessarily mold exposed or not really sensitive to mold, if the long-term use of the mold-based antibiotics could increase their sensitivity or susceptibility. I'm wondering if it like could, you know, go both ways.
But yeah, like, I'm sure it could. Yeah. Cause it's a toxin. So that's, it's just like we were talking about the child who had that exposure in utero. They become very sensitive to mold later in their life. I think that can definitely happen. Yeah.
So, I mean, so it's like a always a too, tough,
it's a tough spot to be in, you know, as a parent and practitioner of just like, okay, we have a kid who's really needing support. What's the best way to support them right now? And, you know, that's in my Panda's Pans book, is I have a lot of plant medicine in there for that very reason, because I don't want to be ruining the microbiome while we're trying to get them better.
Yeah. And I mean, like even as a homeopath, there are like, I'm never in favor of like the long-term use of antibiotics where we're just basically like, let's just take antibiotics for 3 to 7 years and just, you know, until you're 21 and somehow magically at 21, this isn't going to be a problem anymore. And like, you're just going to take antibiotics and, you know, I'm not a fan of that. We do sometimes recommend short-term use of antibiotics when it's appropriate for an active infection, just to help the body deal with it quickly in a way that we know, is likely to not lead to more long-term issues if we're doing a short-term situation than like letting it go and creating more problems with, you know, like an active strep infection that goes untreated for a very long time. So that's just one example, but it can get really confusing then too, because you can have like the disrupted microbiome from the antibiotic and then potentially changing the way that people react to mold depending on the antibiotic. So just one more place that we can just add like complexity to this whole thing, right?
So
which is why
complexity. Yeah. And not everybody has your skill set. Like, I don't have that skill set with homeopathy. So for me, I do have kids who've had to be on for years that were hypogammaglobulinemia. You know, they didn't have the immune system there. And it's like, they're continuing to get sick and continuing to get sick, and insurance won't pay for IVIG. And so we're in that situation where it's like, we're just trying to hold the court for a little while. And with the skill set I have, and that's where then it's great to refer. It's great to have you out there and, you know, all these different doctors that have different skill sets.
For sure. It really takes a village. It takes a village. And, you know, like we've got kids, we do have kids that are on long-term stuff, and we work with it. We always have to work with what the person is dealing with. It's just, I wish we could find a way around it. And I think that working together, we can, yeah. Right? So.
Absolutely. Yeah. I just cherish having you as a person to be sending people to, and, you know,
likewise,
it's so great, because we just need, it is a really complex situation, and it's always multifactorial. I mean, is mold part of the picture in a lot of cases? Yes. But there's lots of other stuff too. You know, there's the glyphosate soccer field toxic kid, or the, you know, all the different things that they can lead to this.
Well, while I have you here, I got to ask one more like just burning question, doc to doc, and like that I'm sure lots of moms will be grateful that we're going to chat about, is binders. I feel like binders are just like big thing for everybody right now. What's the binder we should take? Everybody needs to be on a binder. I have concerns about binders, because binders aren't selectively binding the one thing you want them to. You can't just like sit down with it and have a conversation and say, we're going to bind this, this, and this, but you're going to leave all of my nutrients alone, and you're not going to impact any of the other things that I'm taking. So tell me, let's just talk to me about binders.
Oh, binders. I wrote an article for the Townsend Letter about mold treatment. It was like, you know, I was just kind of given, it was a warm up for me to write my book. And I didn't mention binders at all. And I got so many emails, you didn't even mention binders. And I was like, that's because I'm a naturopathic doctor. And that when we really think about, you know, I think I've become an unintentional binder disruptor in this conversation. And it's not my intention to be controversial. It's just that this is how I was trained, you know, like Dr. Crinian, is talking about these things that bind bile really well, which is how we get rid of fat soluble toxins, is insoluble fiber. So kind of, I've already taken care of that with a low mold, high binder diet by using insoluble fiber as a supplement. So if we look at like in a water damage building exposure, we're taking it in through our respiratory passages. That's how we take in the mycotoxin. Do people eat mycotoxins in their diet? Yes. We've had mycotoxins in our diet for a very long time. So we are a little bit mycotoxin obligate through our diet. There can be really, really bad food processing that, you know, makes it super toxic. Like I work with the Mandingo people in Ghana, and they are just like, they're having kidney cancer from peanuts that are super moldy. And when it's too moldy, they don't make food out of it. They make soap and use it on their skin. And I'm just like, no. That's not a bypass. So yeah, are there situations, and there are studies that show that certain kinds of foods are a little higher in mold and mycotoxins than others. But in a water damage building exposure, we're taking it in through our respiratory passages. And because those mycotoxins are nanoparticles, they go right into the depths of our lungs. They get carried right into the capillaries. They don't need a toll-like receptor or a carrier protein. No escort needed at all. They just get soaked right into the blood. That's why they can go anywhere in the body and cause almost any kind of symptom. So when they're in the blood, then it can take two pathways. It can go to the kidneys to get peed out. And that's, we have two of them and one liver. So a lot of the mycotoxins are going out through the kidneys. And that is where bioflavonoids are extremely important. So the idea of putting someone on a binder and not paying attention to what two out of the three organs need make no sense to me at all. So the bioflavonoids allow the mycotoxins to come off the albumin so the kidney can just get rid of it. When it's bound to albumin, the kidneys can't get rid of it and we have to rely on the liver. So then I have this little rule of thumb, bioflavonoids before binders, because we, you know, support the kidneys. Like we're completely ignoring the kidneys in this conversation. So then it goes, that doesn't get taken out by the kidneys, goes to the liver and it gets bound in bile. The bile then goes to the gut, and then we want to grab or sequester that bile. That's what like cholestyramine and Welchol are doing. The bile is also where we have all our fat soluble vitamins and we recycle about 93% of it for a reason. There's a reason why we need to be recycling that. But if we, you know, if we don't interrupt that recycling, we're going to take on the toxin again. And we ask the liver to take care of it again. And that's where you can get into this loop of the liver having to process the same toxin over and over again. Well, what makes a really good bile binder? Insoluble fiber. Psyllium husk, it can be as cheap can be. And then you don't have to be like this binder for this mycotoxin and this binder for this mycotoxin and this binder for this mycotoxin, because you're not really binding the mycotoxin unless you're eating a lot of mycotoxins. You can just bind the bile, and insoluble fiber feeds your beneficial species, your microbiome. So you've just done two things beneficial at once. There are other things, if people can't tolerate binders, that we can do, like taurine will block bile reabsorption. Like there's some things like that we can get really creative. And if someone can't do insoluble fiber, if they have SIBO, we can use some of the SIBO friendly things, certain seeds like pumpkin, sesame, and sunflower. But kale and mustard greens and collard greens, when you steam them, that was found to be about 15% as effective as cholestyramine. So they did a pound to pound comparison. And in real living bodies, I think it was a rat study. And I was like, why not that? Because that's actually, those are high in vitamin A. Those are, so they're binding, but they're giving back. You know, they're like, oh, I'm going to take this bile, but here's a little extra vitamin A and vitamin C and vitamin E for you. So you can replete your stores. So that's my approach to binders, is let's really monitor in the early stages. Are we getting the mycotoxins out of the diet that we know are problematic kinds of things, like corn? Corn's really, really mycotoxic. So let's just take, let's just take a break from corn for the beginning part, and then start some insoluble fiber as a supplement, or, you know, one of the steamed greens. And then right when I'm about to start antifungals, if somebody needs that, I'll start them on some charcoal just to try to get that first die off taken care of. But other than that, I don't really use binders for most patients that aggressively. And I definitely do not use clay long-term in children. Clay is a binder of a lot of necessary minerals for kids. And I live in farm country, and the farmers here, like the dairy farmers, they do not use clay more than 3 days with any calf because they'll see that they have cavities and the mama cows won't be able to make milk if they put them on clay for too long. So I'm like, why do we have people on clay for years at a time? That doesn't make any sense to me. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've had a number of patients that came to me, really smart doctors, you know, and I'm doing consultations and they'd been on cholestyramine for a year, 9 months, a year. And all of their symptoms now were nutritional depletions from being on the binder that long. Their glycine was low. Their taurine is low. These are all things that are in bile. So we can be too aggressive and cause problems. Yeah.
You know me, being primarily a homeopath, like everything that we can do to just gently nudge the body, like give it, you know, establish the conditions for health, remove obstacles to healing, nudge the body to do what it wants to do on its own. And it can do really remarkable things, which is why I'm sure there's a whole lot of people you've worked with that do like the first two bits of your five-pronged approach, and they don't need to do anything else. And it's, you know, especially like especially if they're using homeopathy, they're working on that susceptibility component too. I would, you know, I know that you've got a lot of respect for homeopathy, even though it's not like the thing that you do. I know you use it a decent amount.
Yeah. Through, so. I'm just not good at it. Yeah. Like we the remedy has to be like a billboard. Like this is a classic case of arsenicum. And then I'm like, okay, I feel confident with this. So
This is why I'm so grateful that we've got people like you though, who are really good. Like you, it's like, you can see all the moving pieces and together. And I hear all this. And I'm like, I know all these things, but then I get overwhelmed trying to manipulate and manage it. And I'm like, I'm going to be lazy. I'm just going to give a remedy to the body and trust that the body's going to figure it out. And when it doesn't, that's when I will say, hey, maybe you should call Dr. Krista.
Right.
This is why I love that you guys are in the same space. Like, I feel like I could just sit here and listen to y'all talk back and forth. And it's the great thing because it's truly what we're all coming to a deeper understanding of is that something different works for each of our kids. And the fact, just even the fact that you two are having a conversation with us as Pan's parents, it's awesome that coming together and figuring it out for each kiddo together is a super cool thing.
Yeah. Panda's parents are my heroes. It's just, oof.
Seriously. And you're one of them. So you are
a hero. Yeah. Well, I did not and still do not do it all that gracefully. I mean, I see families in my clinic and I'm just like, wow, that was a really good idea that they had. I wish I would have thought of that.
But that's the thing is, like, we all have to learn from each other, you know, like I am a better doctor because of having worked with parents like Jody, who I've learned so much from. I wouldn't be the type of doctor and this level of success that I have if I hadn't learned from people. So, Well, Dr. Krista, we are so grateful for the time that you've given us, the generosity, for your book that is an excellent resource that we've both utilized for various different things in our own personal lives and we are happy to recommend to other people. We always love to end on a little bit of hope. What can you offer to people who are dealing with mold, who might be worried about mold being like a big factor for them? What sort of hope can you offer them?
I think, you know, it starts from the front cover of my book. I didn't put anything re-traumatizing in my book at all. No pictures of mold. It's only pictures of solutions. And that is the thing, is that in this world of mold, you're going to hear all the horror stories. You're going to hear it's hard. It's difficult. It's scary, you know, that kind of thing, like the hard thing. It can feel very dense. It can feel very dark. And that's what I think it's important to continuously lift yourself up and realize that it can take a long time, but it doesn't have to be hard. Mm-hmm. So as much as you can do to keep it light and to keep your eye on solutions, I think is the most important thing. You know, like I end my book saying, stay in the light, because, you know, some of this mold wants, like, it does this Jedi mind trick to put you into anxious, overwhelm. We're never going to find a solution. Why don't we just give up? Why don't we just stay here? You know, you just kind of make these decisions that are not health promoting. And that's, again, where homeopathy can be like, boom, nope, you know, continue to strike the staff toward health. But yeah, just continue to stay in the light and keep it light. Keep, you know, get a sense of humor. It's a huge thing. And getting outside away from that influence, away from that coherence. And if anyone's having trouble with that, I'm a little woo, so I created a guided visualization. It's completely free. It's on my website to help people lift away from the coherence of mold. So if you don't have the ability to see a talented homeopath that can do the same thing, this is a visualization people can listen to, and it's best to listen to it with, you know, stereo sound, especially if you're on the way to look at a new house or an apartment or something where you're moving to health. Don't bring the coherence of mold with you, or you will find it on the other end of that. So that's what that guided visualization is about, shaking people off that coherence and lifting into the light.
All right. So it can be done. You can heal from mold illness. It yes. might take time, but staying patient and staying persistent and healing is definitely possible.
Yeah. It doesn't have to
where
be hard.
Where can people find more about you?
At drkrista.com, drcrista.com. And I'm at on Instagram and Facebook and all those, YouTube, all those places, trying to get the word out.
Yep. And we'll make sure we have links to that and everything else that you've referenced in our conversation today in the show notes for people for ease. So thank you so much. It's great to see you again. It's been a while. It was lovely to chat with you and to pick your brain.
Yeah. What a fun, this is so fun for naturopaths to just be like, let's talk about something for an hour. It's great.
and fun for Pan's moms to listen to too.
Cool.
So thank you from the entire Pan's community. I know everyone will really appreciate this conversation.
Thank you. And I'm glad you guys are on the other side of your mold story.
Yes. Me too.
Yeah.
All right. Take care, everybody.
We hope you found this episode helpful, hopeful, and inspiring. We try to get a new episode out every week. You can make sure you don't miss any by following us on Spotify or subscribing to our channel on YouTube. If you want to connect with us more, join our Facebook group, Homeopathy for Pans and Pandas, where we have exclusive weekly videos and answer your questions about, you guessed it, homeopathy for Pans and Pandas throughout the week. If you are already a member, give us a shout out and let us know what you thought about this episode. If you aren't on Facebook and would like to reach us, you can email us at podcast@resiliencenaturopathic.com. Until next time, take care and remember, this won't be forever.